This is The Takeaway. I'm Arun Venugopal, filling in for Tanzina Vega. She'll be back on Monday, and Amy Walter is in tomorrow, as usual. No internet, no cell phones, no landlines. For over 3 weeks, India has imposed a media and communication blackout in Kashmir. In early August, Prime Minister Narendra Modi, whose party embraces Hindu nationalism, revoked the autonomy of the Muslim-majority state, arrested local leaders, and imposed political rule from New Delhi. The blackout has meant that millions of people in the state have not been able to communicate with the outside world, so reports on conditions in Kashmir have been scarce.
What we saw was anger building up in people, and there's only so much that people are able to hold back.
Karan Singh is a freelance journalist who's been working with the New York Times to report on Kashmir. He went to Srinagar, the largest city in Kashmir and at the heart of one of the world's most militarized conflict zones. Karan spoke with us about this blackout and how India's deployment of tens of thousands of troops to Kashmir is making a volatile political situation even worse.
They've basically been asked to stay inside their houses. These are young people who've been running businesses. These are people who've been going to shops. They have work to do, and they're being asked to sit at home. They're being asked to stay inside. It's almost like a prison. Some of the people that I spoke with, they said, if you make us feel like prisoners, we have no choice but to come out on the streets and protest and demand our rights.
People have taken to the streets and protested, and they've been met by heavily armed police who've often used force against protesters.
The security forces in Kashmir have license to shoot with near impunity, and we saw security forces reacting to protests with pellet guns and also tear gas. And if you're shot from close range, people who we spoke with, they said they even had the entire cartridge lodged in their flesh. It penetrates the skin. These are lead pellets. When fired, they're literally sprayed across, and anyone can get hit, like children, women. People lose their eyesight when they're shot with pellets.
These injuries have put a strain on the hospital system in Kashmir, where the blackout has severely hampered medical services.
In one hospital alone, we heard about 60 cases of pellet injuries. And I think the communications blackout also has an effect on the medical emergencies in Kashmir. Doctors are not able to source medicines because they're not able to communicate with their suppliers. Hospitals are not able to source prescription drugs. These are life-saving drugs, and they're running out.
India's crackdown on communication in Kashmir is an especially harsh example of something we've been seeing more of around the world, digital authoritarianism. Alina Polyakova is the director of the Brookings Institution Project on Global Democracy and Emerging Technology. Alina, thank you for coming on The Takeaway.
Thank you for having me.
You've been studying the rise of digital authoritarianism. So what did you think when we first learned about the communication blackout in Kashmir?
When this happened in India, it was quite shocking to see a democracy move so aggressively to basically limit, censor, and block those residents residing in Kashmir's ability to communicate, to talk about what's happening. It's a real infringement and violation of free speech and the ability for free assembly as well.
So yes, India, widely considered the world's largest democracy, is this not common amongst so-called democracies?
Over the last few years, we've seen China experiment with some bans like this. We've seen Russia move to try to experiment with these kinds of internet social media blocks. There are some reports that the Chinese government is actually considering either a partial or complete ban on Hong Kong, given the protests that are going there. This is a tool that we're seeing authoritarian regimes deploy, but in some cases, we've also seen countries like Sri Lanka over this past spring. Following some quite shocking terrorist attacks, Sri Lanka also put a temporary internet ban on parts of the territory to prevent what they said was extremist content, conspiracy theories from spreading on social media sites that would have amplified or misled people about the nature of the attacks. So we're seeing these kinds of bans being experimented with primarily by authoritarian regimes. But I think what's becoming troubling with India is that we're now seeing some democracies doing this as well.
And to what extent do you think that there is a backlash to these models? Does it actually create more problems than it tries to solve?
Well, I think, again, we have to distinguish between, you know, democratic societies, free and fair elections, freedom of speech, freedom of assembly, et cetera. And again, I think what's troubling about what's happening in India is that we're seeing this within the context of a democracy, which raises serious questions. What is the role of the digital space in democratic societies during, perhaps, emergency situations? And some would say that, you know, what's happening in Kashmir was a problem of the Indian government's own making, of course. And this is not a state of emergency that doesn't justify what the government is doing in terms of banning any access to the internet. When it comes to authoritarian regimes, this is where we're seeing the really shocking use of digital technologies, things like artificial intelligence algorithms, to surveil in a really profound way the entire population, to try to censor people, repress their ability to speak out, and track people's movements throughout the country. In China, the surveillance state has really grown at a rapid rate, and we don't really even understand the implications of it quite yet. And of course, in countries like Russia, they're trying to replicate this Chinese model with some limited success. And other countries are looking on in Africa, in South America, and they want these kinds of capabilities and technologies as well to be able to control their own domestic populations.
You write about two models of digital authoritarianism, the Chinese model and the Russian model. Can you briefly describe these two models?
Sure. What we've seen emerge in China really since the initial days of internet penetration in that country in the mid-90s, we saw the Chinese government very, very quickly from the very beginning to limit and censor what kind of information was getting into China. We now colloquially call this the Great Firewall of China, but what that really refers to is the Chinese government's, you know, strategic intent, you know, from 20 years ago to filter the information that is getting in front of Chinese citizens. And since then, the Chinese government has only developed new forms of surveillance technologies like video cameras that are now coupled with facial recognition software. The use of Chinese-made social media platforms versus Western platforms, which are banned in China, of course. Now there's a social score system that the Chinese government is moving to implement that will fully allow the Chinese government at a very micro, deep personal level to surveil every single citizen. What we see in Russia is a little different. So in the 1990s, Russia had an opening and the internet developed in a relatively free way. And so once, you know, social media apps are out there, other Western platforms and technologies are already out there being used by the population, like YouTube, it's really difficult to roll that back. And so now we see also a series of protests that have been happening in the last few weeks in Moscow. And many of those protesters are using YouTube to stream instances of police abuse, to broadcast their message. YouTube and other Western outlets have become the key way in which democratic activists and protesters have been able to get the truth across to a broader swath of the population. The Russian government, because of that, actually sent a very threatening letter to YouTube, to Google, threatening them with interference in Russian domestic politics because they were allowing protests to stream examples and video from the protests. They're not succeeding in the same way that the Chinese are, but certainly they're moving quickly to try to replicate that model.
When we talk about how Russia and China have been exporting their own forms of digital authoritarianism, which countries are actually importing them?
So, unfortunately, there's a lot of interest across the world in having access to these surveillance technologies. We know that at least 18 countries currently use Chinese surveillance and monitoring system, everything from video cameras to other forms of facial recognition technology, etc. And the Russians are also part of this game. They have been exporting their surveillance technologies to places like Venezuela, to places like Belarus, Central Asia. And I think this is something we need to be paying a lot of close attention to because it is a profound challenge to what we think of as democratic governance values and principles.
Going back to the situation in Kashmir, the communications blackout there has been especially severe, but it also seems to have been working from the point of view of the Indian government. Do you think that we'll see this move imitated in other places, including in other democracies?
I think, again, the damage, that's the reputational damage, the damage to democratic principles, values, ideals, is really profound. People on the ground can find ways to get around some of these bans. I think in Kashmir, it is this full blackout ban. It's not a partial ban that we've seen in some other places before. I think democracies, on the other hand, should be paying very close attention to the fact that this kind of ban that the Indian government is carrying out today in Kashmir only breeds resentment and anger among the residents of that region. It's in the long run, it's not going to serve democratic principles to impose these kinds of ban. And certainly goes against free speech and free amendment rights that we have in the United States, free speech rights that you have in all European countries. So I would be really shocked to see another democracy implement these kinds of measures. And I would certainly hope it doesn't become a pattern.
Alina Polyakova is the director of the Brookings Institution's Project on Global Democracy and Emerging Technology. Alina, thank you for joining us.
Thank you, Arun.
Since WNYC's first broadcast in 1924, we've been dedicated to creating the kind of content we know the world needs. Since then, New York Public Radio's rigorous journalism has gone on to win a Peabody Award and a DuPont Columbia Award, among others. In addition to this award-winning reporting, your sponsorship also supports inspiring storytelling and extraordinary music that is free and accessible to all. To get in touch and find out more, visit sponsorship.wnyc.org.